Iraq has been a divisive issue in this country.
We're dealing with other things today.
Far too many young couples find it hard to own their own homes on the things that matter to people.
It's irresponsible and it's wrong, and they should...
We have to make sure that we focus jobs and living standards and the National Health Service and schools. People worry about disrespect on the street.
I've always believed...
The British people...
Many years ago came Tony Blair.
Look at my face.
Right, what are you doing?
Is my face bothered?
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Cigar Stream. We're back with the Summer of Tone 2024. I wasn't actually planning on this, but such is the presence of the Dark Lord in British politics at the moment that it's almost impossible to ignore him. And there's been a number of key interviews and things that have come out, which I will deal with in the coming weeks. I am also going on holiday. Not next week, but the week after. And I'm hoping to pre-record at least two Dark Lord watches to air during that week in lieu of Cigar Stream and Popular Opinions. But tonight, we're going to be taking a kind of deeper look at the behind-the-scenes power players of the new Keir Starmer government, because it didn't take Tone long to make a dramatic intervention into the running of the country. He basically wrote a 1,500 word essay in the Sunday Times advising the government on all sorts of things. He is more or less openly backseat driving the government at this point. And I think we're going to see some court intrigue in the coming weeks. But before we get to all of that, let me just remind everybody, do buy my courses at the Academic Agency. Shall we play a ad for old time's sake? Yes. Buy the Trivium today.
Academic Agency.
All right, yes, do pick up those courses. Still selling well, of course, and I'm still working on the Foundations of Shakespeare course. Don't have an approximate date for that yet, but I expect it to be out by September at the latest, maybe even earlier. We'll see. All right. So, yes, obviously on this channel, we have been watching the Dark Lord, as we call him, Tony Blair, closely for some years now. And to us, it has been obvious. It is more or less received wisdom at this point on this little corner of the internet that Tony Blair is not just the power behind this throne, but has almost total control over British politics. There are other people, obviously, who have other plans. Obviously, this displeases Tone, because other opinions are not an option in Tony world, as we know. But nonetheless, there are people who have got other ideas. You know, funny that happens in politics, right? Of course, Blair's dream is to have a politics where almost nothing is discussed and his will is just implemented, as we've discussed many times. So today, what we're going to do, I'm going to first of all take a little look at the increased media scrutiny of Blair's influence over Starmer, because it's become so all pervasive and so in your face at this point that it's basically impossible to ignore, even for the mainstream media. The second thing, I'm going to read Blair's intervention in the Sunday Times in full and provide some analysis. And then we're going to have a little look at the fallout from that, because there has been some fallout, and go into a little bit of hidden backstage machinations between various power players, including a character called McSweeney. So I'm going to have a little look at that as well. There's been something called the McSweeney Project, which was covered by Unheard, Who Is It For, last month. So we'll go into some of those details so that you, dear viewer, are fully up to date on what is truly going on in the government of this country. So the first thing I'll just draw your attention to is that it has now become, such as the size of the Tony Blair Institute, that it has become basically impossible for people to ignore, I mean, how much power this man has. The Guido Fawkes basically drew attention to the fact that the Tony Blair Institute is absolutely dwarves all of the other think tanks in Westminster at this point. They have 337 employees versus, I mean, the closest one has got 51. Many others have far fewer. For example, the IEA, which is a place I've been to a number of times, only has 30 employees, right? So we're talking about an NGO that is 10 times the size of the IEA. The other thing I'll just note very quickly is that this is just the British employees that Guido Fawkes has listed here. Worldwide, I think it's over 800 employees now. And of course, some of those employees, as you can see here, are pretty famous people. Tomorrow, by the way, which is the 9th of July, the Future of Britain conference is taking place, where basically Blair and his friends are going to outline what policy is going to look like in 6 months' time or a year down the line. I mean, I wouldn't even bother watching a Labour conference anymore. This is where the actual decisions are made. So this, I mean, I would encourage everybody to watch the Future of Britain conference, because what those guys say basically ends up happening, and what everybody else says ends up not happening. But if you can see some of the employees that Blair has now, at this point, you know, I mean, William Hague is working with him, Sanna Marin, the former Prime Minister of Finland, Matteo Renzi, the former Prime Minister of Italy, like these are direct Tony Blair Institute employees now. And even further, you've got General Sir Nick Carter, and you've also got Patrick Vallance as well. And they are all direct employees of Blair now. They are advisors, you know, strategic advisors. And Sir Patrick Vallance is back in the government. I think he's been given some sort of post by Starmer. So this is pretty visible stuff at this point, and it's almost impossible to ignore. And the Independent, for some reason, doesn't seem to like Tony Blair. I get the impression that the Independent, of all the newspapers, is the least kind of regime compliant when it comes to a lot of these things. And it has a lot of leftists working there. And they have been on to Blair for some time now, pointing out that, you know, he's influencing the government. Look, they've got that kind of rather demonic looking Blair laugh there. Just yesterday, they released another basically hit piece saying that Starmer is getting regular texts from Tony Blair. Whether or not he wants it, Starmer is getting advice from Blair on a daily basis via text message. Now, I have to say that I am a little bit dubious as to the veracity of this story, because Blair has mentioned many, many times that he doesn't have a mobile phone. And this is something that Alistair Campbell has mentioned as well, that Blair is a tech phobe, ironically, given that he's a tech champion. But in his personal life, he keeps a very clean profile, so it's almost impossible to get into touch with him and stuff like that. So I'm not sure whether this story is true. And if you read it, there's not a lot of substance there. But basically the Independent have got this line in drawing attention to the influence of the Dark Lord. The New Statesman, the left wing, I would say is basically the counterpart to the Spectator. It's like the left wing equivalent of the Spectator, a kind of political magazine read by Labour voters as opposed to Tory voters. And Andrew Marr had a piece in there back in March talking about the battle for Keir Starmer's soul. Various different people trying to get the ear of Starmer. And if you read this, there are a number of characters who will come back on back to later who are important. One of them is Sue Gray. She is a particularly influential figure. She is somebody we'll come back to later on. Morgan McSweeney is another one. This is the McSweeney project that we'll talk to soon. There are other characters as well. But of course, looming above all of them is Blair and the Tony Blair Institute. And, basically Andrew Marr in this piece says, like, yes, there's Sue Gray and there's Morgan McSweeney, but there's also like the Blairites. And, he says, look, in the swishy, discreet offices near the BBC, the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change, or TBI, is there, basically. And General Sir Nick Carter, Patrick Vallance, blah, blah, blah. With Starmer and Blair talking regularly, the TBI has been seconding researchers to help the Labour leader and his team. Left MPs see a plot by the Blairites to abduct Starmer and put his more pro-state, class-bound politics quietly to sleep. And some of Starmer's old political and legal friends complain that he is becoming unreachable, protected by a human parasite of smart young globalists. But Blair himself seems knowing about the relationship. He told Tom Baldwin for his recent biography of Starmer that the reason they talk, despite Starmer being to his left, is that the civil service doesn't have the expertise a Labour government will need. It needs outside help. Basically, everybody needs my help. That is Blair's sell. So you see the basic issue here, right, is that while the Dark Lord looms very large over British politics and over Starmer, there are still, obviously, it's the Labour Party, there are still a lot of left-wingers there. And so Blair's control over the party is not total. And this is going to be one of the ongoing themes, I think, of the Starmer government. And certainly it's going to be an ongoing theme in this particular stream that we're watching. So with that in the background, let us read Sir Tony's intervention. This is a long article, about 1,500 words, in the Sunday Times. Tony Blair, my advice to Keir Starmer. Now, I will read this and pause for comment when I find it necessary, okay? in full. The only Labour leader to lead the party to three general election victories says the new PM's achievement is immense, and this is what he should do now. Right, note the date, Saturday, July the 6th, 2024, in the Sunday Times. So, and we've talked about this many times, when Blair intervenes, he always does it on the weekend, typically on a Sunday, to grab the Sunday headlines, to set the tempo for the discussion for the entire week. Blair always does that. And in the years we've been following him, all of his quote unquote interventions, which happen about every 2 months, it seems, you know, are timed in this way. And certainly it was trending on Twitter, and it was the big talk yesterday going into today. So it's, you know, it's Monday today now. And that is, it seems, how the news cycle in the UK at least works. The Sunday papers set the tempo for the week, unless something else big happens, right? Anyway, here is tone. He says, first, the obvious. The achievement of Keir Starmer is immense. It is the most remarkable turnaround in recent British electoral history and the most stunning in the 120-year history of the Labour Party. His leadership, his changing of Labour, has been focused, determined, and ruthlessly effective. Focus. He appointed exceptional talent to conduct the charge, the change, and put the most capable front benchers in the most important positions for future government. These are all qualities that bode well for his leadership of the country. But there is no doubting that this was also the most peculiar election of recent times. There was a huge desire not just to put the Conservative Party out, but to punish them. That's right, tone. Labour was a credible instrument of punishment. An electoral system really designed for two big parties, as possibly one also ran, has seen not two, but four parties, all with double-digit proportions of the vote, plus another two also-rans and different varieties of independent, splitting many constituency ballots, so resulting in a landslide result. Keir will be acutely aware of this. By the way, there is a subtext to this, which is that, yeah, it was a big landslide, but it wasn't a Blair 97 win, was it? And he is basically like, there is a little bit of kind of reminder, everybody. Keir didn't win this because he was popular, like me. He won this because of all of these factors. And, you know, I'll refer you back to the video I put out a couple of days back, the election post-mortem, which went through all of that sort of stuff. Anyway, however, people voted for disparate parties, knowing full well that doing so would give Labour a big majority. The last throw of the Tory dice was to call upon the electorate not to give Labour a landslide and to explain precisely how this might happen. The advice was ignored, and we have to conclude deliberately. Well, I would say it wasn't fully ignored, as per my analysis the other day. Yes, it was a thumping Labour win. It wasn't zero seats, though. It wasn't zero seats. So the Tories did enough to live to fight another day, I would suggest. But anyway. So he has a mandate. It is for change, for sure. But what type of change exactly? Stability, not chaos. But after that, what Labour voters want and what Reform UK voters want can point in different directions. What Liberal Democrats want, other than quote-unquote good things, is frequently a bit of a mystery. And though we know what Green voters want, and many people support the general aim of protecting the environment, most people do not support their policies. You can make an argument that, although the country has chosen the centre-left to govern, its political centre of gravity also contains signs of moving right. Tone, absolutely on the money. The most astute senior political voice in the country absolutely has it spot on. That is exactly right analysis from Blair there. Doesn't really take a genius to figure out either. Here is where Keir's decision to keep his manifesto tight and refuse to mimic a Tory manifesto full of unrealizable promises is a blessing. The five missions he has set out, covering economic growth, the NHS, crime, education, and clean energy, are absolutely the right ambitions, and they cover areas of concerns that stretch across most of the country. Now he'll work on a plan to deliver them. And with the ministers he has chosen, and people such as the formidable Sue Gray helping to organise the system, he has sensibly given himself the talent and the room to formulate it, free from too much preconceived baggage. The hardest part of coming into government is recognising that the skill set that brought you to government is not the same as the skill set that you need to stay there. Winning power is about, i.e., fucking listen to me. I.e., now you're in the government, you have to listen to me fully. That's basically the subtext of all of what he's saying here. Winning power is all about being the great persuader. Exercising power is all about being the great chief executive. And what have I been saying for weeks, right? When Blair built the machine, right? And the analogy I keep on making is, imagine a machine that only works if on fingerprints, right? So you need the fingerprint and you put your fingerprint in the slot there and everything works, okay? When the Tories were in power, they kept on putting their fingerprints and it was access denied. Now Blair is back in power, all the machinery of the state will work again. It will work for Starmer, okay? But bear in mind, it won't work for Starmer because he's the Labour leader. Just any old Labour leader. It will only work for Starmer if he is Blairite, okay? And Blair's basic vision is Schmittian, right? He wants to wield executive, unaccountable, Hobbesian power with no account, with no feedback loop, no accountability, no democratic process. All of that bullshit is swept aside in the Blairite vision. The chief executive basically gets to wield executive action, Schmittian decisionist executive power. That is what Blair wants to see, right? Because that's how anything gets done in any power system, including our own. And Starmer, he's basically reminding Starmer here of the fact that the machinery won't work if he starts doing commie stuff or Brownite stuff or left-wing stuff. It's only going to work if it does Blairite stuff, right? Anyway, let's carry on. The former role consists of speeches, symbolic moments of connection, slogans, kissing babies, wooing voters, and all the performative art of a good campaign. The latter role is about the intellectual and practical graft of policy and delivery. Guess which is harder? The size of Labour's majority gives the new government a massive opportunity to put in place a policy agenda that can transform the country over time and bring into being a new coalition of support. If it starts with a hard-headed appreciation of reality, it is of the realities it is inheriting and the way the world is changing. Britain's politics over the past few years has often been depressingly introspective at the very moment the world is turning on its axis. The Labour Party always wants to correct social injustice, and quite rightly. But this Labour leadership understands that without economic growth and reform of services and welfare, it will be unable to do so. Keir and Rachel Reeves, the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, recognise we have reached the limits of traditional tax and spend to solve our problems. We have at present high levels of both and high levels of debt, but poor outcomes in a horrible and unvirtuous circle. There are things that can be done. Where does that link lead, I wonder? It leads to another article in the Times. Okay. All right. To kickstart economic growth, in particular, reforming the hopelessly slow and bureaucratic planning system, both infrastructure and housing, and fixing the worst aspects of the post-Brexit trade deal. But the only game changer is the full embrace of potential of technology, especially the new developments in artificial intelligence. For this reason, I don't think there has ever been a better or more exciting time to be governing. My institute this week will hold its Future of Britain conference. To coincide with it, we will publish detailed reports that show how the unvirtuous circle can be turned virtuous by accelerating the application of technological innovation. The spread of the application of AI by the private sector and its encouragement by appropriate government policy is the only answer to Britain's productivity challenge. And over time, it can turbocharge, I hate that word, by the way, growth. We show how a switch to prevention in healthcare using new treatments for everything from cardiovascular disease and cancer protection to obesity drugs not only yields benefits in health, but the wealth of the country, adding employment and growth. We need this urgently. Since 2019, we have seen the number of working age people off on long-term sickness rise by 800,000 to a record 2.8 million. Spending on disability and incapacity benefits have risen by a whopping £18 billion. And spending on mental health in England is now 10% of the NHS budget. We show how applying AI to the processes of government can cut the workforce time by 20%. And by a specific analysis of the work for Department for Work and Pensions, how both the way the department operates and the service it gives to those who depend on it can be transformed, as well as the large benefit fraud bill. Using study. Now, the thing is, this sounds like a sales pitch, right? But you have to understand that when Blair says this stuff in the Sunday Times, it's not really a request or a kind of, it's not really advice so much as it is an order. You will do this, basically. And I mean, this is what we've learned over, you know, over the years of watching Blair. He tends to get his way. And I'll be very interested to see what happens if any of this is defied, right? If the Labour aren't ready to do any of this stuff for any reason, I'll be interested to see what happens, because I wouldn't put it past Tone and Co. to get rid of Starmer and stick someone else in. We saw what they did to Johnson and Truss, right? I mean, those same mechanisms are still available. So anyway, let's continue. Using studies from around the world, we show how AI can change education, both for teachers and students. And we highlight the fact that after the US and China, Britain occupies third position in AI globally, and therefore focusing on it and associated areas such as life sciences and clean energy is the right industrial strategy. Over two terms of government, we estimate the savings run into the tens of billions, allowing us to get growth back to the levels it was in the early part of the century. For the avoidance of doubt, I know this technological revolution has its downsides. And generative AI, like any general purpose technology, can be used for bad as well as good. But it is a fact. Actually, the 21st century technological revolution is the real world fact that will change everything. The question is whether we have the imagination to harness it. The companies and countries that do will prosper, and those that don't will fall behind. And at least let's debate it. After a campaign with a week on Rishi Sunak and D-Day, another week on more on the betting scandal, and then endless discussion of polls, not policy, there is surely an appetite. Note, by the way, Blair's absolute disdain and distaste for mundane day-to-day party politics. He hates it. You know, why are you talking about this bullshit, you know, scandals and D-Day and so on? Let's get to the real business of policy. Policy meaning the system doing stuff that he wants, of course. Then there is the challenge of reform. He's talking about Nigel Farage here. The challenge of reform. Here is where British politics has much in common with European politics. Indeed, all over the Western world, traditional political parties are suffering disruption. where the system embeds the two parties, the disruption is internal. Where the system allows new entrants to emerge, they are running riot anywhere. Look at France or Italy. Cultural issues, as much of it is not more than economic issues, are at the heart of it. Reform has pillaged the Tory vote in this election, true, but it poses a challenge for Labour too. We need a plan to control immigration. If we don't have rules, we get prejudices. In office, I believe the best solution was a system of identity so that we know precisely who has a right to be here. With, again, technology, we should move, as the world is moving, to digital ID. If not, new border controls will have to be highly effective. We need a tough new approach to law and order. At present, criminal elements are modernizing faster than law enforcement, and the government should avoid any vulnerability on quote-unquote wokeism. There is also clearly a challenge in the part of the Muslim community, but that is a topic requiring its own special analysis. Again, this is something I've covered very extensively on this channel. Tone is saying, strafe right, contain, strafe right, contain, strafe right, contain, strafe right, contain. Direct orders of the Dark Lord. And he's warning Labour, do not go left in any respect on any of these issues, otherwise you're toast. And he's right about that. He is absolutely right about that. If Labour come in and do bullshit left-wing stuff, they are going to be hammered in the next election. I can guarantee you that. So he is correct. And also, don't forget, only 9.6 million people voted for Starmer, so they're vulnerable, very vulnerable. The country has decided to give Keir and his team a go, that voters should hand Labour one of its biggest victories so soon after handing the party one of its biggest defeats is an enormous tribute to that team. An enormous tribute to me. That's what, again, the subtext. It doesn't matter that, though the chapter headings are in bold print, there are pages of detail to be written. That's an advantage. I will write the detail. The Labour Party. I mean, again, the subtext to everything here is listen to me and do as I say. Do not displease me. The Labour Party won, as it always does, by returning to the centre-left. But contrary to the common critique, the centre ground is not the place of the mushy middle between the poles of right and left. It is the place of solutions, not ideology, where policy comes first and the politics comes second. It can't be sensible and radical at the same time. And that is what the country needs. All of you sensible centrists here, this is music to your ears, isn't it? Not solutions, not ideology. I quite agree, Sir Tone, as one of YouTube's resident sensible centrists. I quite agree. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things that happened is that when Blair released this article yesterday, it somewhat blew up on Twitter and got a lot of pushback because, as everybody knows, digital ID is something, or ID card, is something that Blair has been obsessed with since at least 2005. It was one of the only things he was, only votes he was defeated on during his own time as Prime Minister. And ever since, in the 20 years since then, he has been like a dog with a, he has been relentless in his pursuit of getting that ID thing back on the table. Some might say that it is his signature policy, the thing that he just cannot let go, and he will not stop until Britain and every other country, it seems, adopts digital ID. Right, it is. He for 20 straight years he has pushed this hard using whatever influence he has. And again, the Times were onto this 2 years back, where it was talked about that Labour are reviving the ID cards idea. And it was Stephen Kinnock, who was the shadow immigration minister back then, talking about it, and of course, you know, Blair has his fangs into Kinnock. There you go. In July, a report. This is July 2022. The Tony Blair Institute recommended introducing universal mandatory digital identity cards to help alleviate the migrant crisis. So, you know, they're using immigration basically as the method to try to force this through. And which I predicted years ago, by the way, that this would be the Blair play. I also predicted that there would come a time where people would, you know, start to say, well, maybe this is a good idea. And I have to say that I mean, a lot of people are worried about the prospect of digital ID. And I do think that the worry is somewhat overblown, right? You know, on the more extreme end, it's like, oh, they bring that in and it will be like China social credit system, right? I mean, the way I look at it is this. One, I already have ID, right? I've got a driving license and a passport, which are linked to computer systems. Second thing is that the government know my name. They know where I live. They know how much money I earn. They know how much tax I pay. They know how I earn my money. They know my date of birth. They know, I mean, there's almost no detail that the government, they know my medical history. I mean, there's nothing that the government don't know about me, right? And that's true of everybody watching this as well. They know everything about you already. So, so the introduction of digital ID only really formalizes that which is already in place, right? I'm under no bones about living in a free society. It's just an illusion, right? We don't have freedom. We already live in the, you know, to quote Aaron McIntyre, in the total state. So it's a fiction, isn't it? So introducing this, okay, it's another nail in the coffin of, you know, Magna Carta or whatever bullshit. But let's face it, during Brexit, they tried to use, or during the COVID, they actually tried to use Magna Carta in court, and were laughed at. They were just laughed at trying it. So functionally, those things are dead anyway, because politics is always Schmittian, right? Power will always do what it wants, unconstrained by law. Hobbes, De Maistre, Schmitt, these guys were right about that. All rest is fiction. They're not going to be constrained by the law. They're the government. By definition, that which is sovereign is above the law. It makes the law. When you act, it becomes law. And this is something that people struggle to get their heads around. But it's just true, basically, that it is a fiction. Those times in history when the sovereign has had to make concessions, what I would call containment, I would call Magna Carta containment, all right? All that means is that there another group was, you know, was able to exercise more power, or power to rival the sovereign, i.e. there was a genuine rival castle there, which constrained the power. It wasn't because the law was there. That was a function of the actual power dynamics at play, okay? But in a situation where there is absolute power, there is no constraint, regardless of what the law says. And this is something that I think people struggle with that, especially boomers struggle with that concept more than anyone else. American constitutionalists and people who have this from the English common law tradition and all of that. I'm afraid to say it's all fiction, and it's always has been fiction. Power will get away with whatever it can get away with. The only checks and balances on power are from rival castles. That's what Magna Carta was. The actual law being on the books didn't prevent things down the line, didn't prevent Henry VIII wielding absolutist power down the line. because the relative power positions of the nobility and the king had changed by that point. So anyway, let us now look at what happened here, because Blair basically, you know, told Starmer all of this stuff, or the article I've just read. And initially, what happened is that this business secretary, whose name is Jonathan Reynolds, said that they will be looking at all sources of advice. But then, I guess after backlash on Twitter or whatever else, they rejected it. Now, this was a stunning moment. This was a stunning moment in British politics. This shocked me. You don't defy the Dark Lord. If he tells you to introduce ID cards, you do it. But Labour are publicly rejecting Blair's call for ID cards. And I will just read the BBC article here. The Labour government has ruled out the introduction of digital ID cards after former Labour Prime Minister Sir Tony Blair said they could help control immigration. Business Secretary Jonathan Reynolds initially said that the Home Secretary would be looking at all sources of advice on the issue. However, he later told Times Radio ID cards are not... he later told Times Radio that ID cards were not part of the government's plans. Home Secretary Yvette Cooper said ID cards were not in the party's election manifesto and added, "That's not our approach." I've noticed this writer does not believe in commas or punctuation of any sort. This Becky Morton, if you're watching, Becky, you can use a comma occasionally, you know. Home Secretary Yvette Cooper said ID cards were not in the party's election manifesto and added, "That's not our approach." So Tony brought in legislation for compulsory identity cards when he was in office, but the scheme was scrapped by the Conservative and Liberal Democrat coalition government. Writing in the Sunday Times, Sir Tony said, "We need a plan to control immigration. If we don't get rules, we get prejudices. In office, I believe the best solution was a system of identity so that we know precisely who has a right to be here. With, again, technology, we should move as the world is moving to digital ID. If not, new border controls will have to be highly effective." I do think, coming back to the basic idea of the digital ID. So I went on my big rant about, the Schmittian exception and power always being executive and decisionist, right? Essentially wielded monarchically. So the civic concerns are, I'm afraid, just kind of legalistic fairy dust. Basically, you're campaigning over something symbolic if you're against it on those grounds. But practically speaking, I don't really see the problem. Like, it would basically solve a lot of issues, wouldn't it? Because it would make both voter fraud impossible, i.e. would stop illegals, you know, getting involved with voting. I don't know how big that is a problem in this country anyway. And then the second thing is that, you know, if your digital ID was linked to, for example, the Visa MasterCard system, it would make it very difficult to operate if you were an illegal immigrant. Of course, people are worried that these mechanisms could be turned back and used on the natives, of course. Yes, that is a risk that is always run. But we are living in an environment where a chap was sent to jail for putting stickers on lampposts. So, you know, in a way, that ship has already sailed, if you want to put it that way. The pretense that we're not living in a totalitarian state, that ship has sailed. So if this power would actually make it impossible, for example, to operate a Turkish barber or a vape shop or something like that in the way that they do at the moment, can only be a good thing, in my view. So I don't know. I don't have the reflexive kind of hatred of the digital ID that so many people do, because I'm not a libertarian. Anyway, or I've never been a civic libertarian. In any case, because I just don't believe that those things exist. I honestly believe that when it comes to the government and the law, it's a fiction, basically. There are no constraints on what the law can do, on what the government can do. There are none. The only constraints the government has is rival power, basically. That is the only check on power, is rival power. So, like, for example, in the ultimate case, Britain could not get away with invading France because the USA would be there like a shot, right? So there are just hard constraints on what power can do. And in the same way that the USA military army is a check on what the British military can do, rival factions, power factions, are a check on what the government can do as well. Okay. And a huge one is business. Big corporations, lobby groups, the city, Wall Street. I mean, this is one massive check on power. We saw they brought the Liz Truss government down. The Bank of England brought down the Liz Truss government on behalf of the city. They showed that they can do that. That was a check on Westminster's power. That is, and the law doesn't matter, right? I mean, everybody at the moment is talking about the legal constraints preventing the Democrats from swapping out Biden for somebody else. Listen, if they want to do it, all that stuff will go out the window. If the system wants Biden gone, he'll be gone. And whatever the reasons, whatever the justifications, whatever the legalities, will be sorted out post hoc. That is really how power is. Anyway, let's continue. Okay, so, but asked if she could rule out introducing digital IDs, Ms. Cooper said, "It's not in our manifesto. That's not our approach." Instead, she said the government was setting up a new enforcement and returns unit, as well as targeting people smuggling gangs to prevent small boats crossings. Asked about the possibility of introducing ID cards, Mr. Reynolds told Times Radio, "We can rule that out. That's not something that's part of our plans." Opponents of identity cards have raised concerns about the potential impact on civil liberties and what they see as unnecessary data collection by the state. Tackling illegal immigration is one of the major challenges facing the new government. So far this year, more than 13,000 people have crossed the channel in small boats. So, what's going on? How are Labour defying the Dark Lord? Basically on day one. So let's have a look. I've got two articles I want to look at before we wrap up here. It's not going to be a terribly long stream. This is Politico. And the article is called "Britain's New Power List: 12 People You Need to Know in the UK Labour Government." British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer is now in office. These are the people who really matter in his government. Incidentally, by the way, did everybody noticed how white the cabinet is? Not a lot of diversity there, is there? And I had to laugh when the cabinet was released. The way the Labour Party spun it was only like one person or like really small percentage of people in this cabinet went to public school. They're all state school educated people. And they were trying to spin that as being one of the most diverse cabinets in history. So basically, you know, diversity is now having Council of State Angela Rayner in the government, as opposed to, you know, the Rainbow Coalition. So that was a funny line. Anyway. A lot of people saw it as evidence that the woke has been put away, but we can come back to that another time. All right, so this is Politico's rundown of who these 12 kind of power players within New Labour 2.0 are. And let's have a little look at who they are. So first of all, there is the bestie, Rachel Reeves. She is the Chancellor of the Exchequer. You'll be getting to know her a bit better soon. That rumour has it, the Tony Blair Institute have listed Rachel Reeves as a to-be-confirmed speaking tomorrow. So it will be interesting to see if Reeves actually does appear at TBI tomorrow. I think that will give us a tell on whether Starmer is looking to distance his government from Blair or whether they're going to lean in closer to Blair. Certainly the mood music, given the rejection of the ID cards, suggests that Blair could be on the outs. I struggle to believe that, though, given that Sir Patrick Vallance is a Blair man and he's been appointed to the government. There was, who was the guy who was put into the NHS? Milburn, I think it was. He was a Blair man, put in there. I mean, there's tons of people. Yeah, Alan Milburn was put in as well. So, you know, Blair has this plan of harnessing data for health. I will just show you if you don't believe me here. This was the Tony Blair Institute a month ago. A new national purpose, harnessing data for health. And lo and behold, who is in the cabinet but Alan Milburn, known for his closeness to Sir Tony. And he supports a greater private sector role in the health service. Now, what did I tell you? I told you all Labour would do stuff like this, right? That when they're in power, they would start privatising parts of the NHS. And lo and behold, Tone has his man in there. So I'll be surprised if, you know, they don't lean in close to Blair, given these actual appointments that we're seeing. A lot of people have suggested that the rejection of the digital ID publicly is kayfabe, and that later it's going to come back in some way. We will see. I.e., too many people were looking at Blair's influence and they needed to do something to show that they're not puppets, something like that. We will see. So anyway, this is the Chancellor. She is seen as a kind of solid, safe pair of hands on economics. She's boring, basically. Then there is Angela Rayner, everybody's favourite, the firebrand. Starmer's outspoken deputy spent the first year. Now, I have heard rumours, by the way, rumours and innuendos on the grapevine that within a year, Angela Rayner will be gone. I can't tell you who has said these sort of things, but you know, on the grapevine, on the Westminster grapevine, it is suggested that they're going to find a way to work Rayner out. I actually think it would be a shame if Rayner's gone. If nothing else, she provides excellent meme value, right? But she is a lol cow for the right, but I think that for the left, or for Starmer in particular, she is a pain in the ass, basically. You know, she overcame that scandal she was involved with. She backed Diane Abbott, and she is the problem is that the deputy leader is directly elected by the party's membership, giving her an alternative base of power to Starmer, right? This is an issue. This is an issue because it means that Rayner kind of has a force field against Blair. I mean, imagine how annoying that is for Tone, to have this idiot. So you've got Blair, on the one hand, you've got Blair saying, listen, we need to put the woke away. We need to, like, you know, do all the stuff, tough on crime, cause of the crime, make a blanket, do all the stuff, do all the things, do all the stuff academic agents have been telling you for the past 5 years, okay? On the other hand, the party membership have different ideas, of course, because they're Labour and they're full of idiots. And, you know, they're stuck with this woman as the deputy head. So, I mean, this is going to be a problem for Starmer if they can't find a way to get rid of her. So, and they've tried and they failed so far. But let's see. It's not as easy as just firing her, you see, because different power base. You see, power is a check on power. And this is a different, this is a rival castle within Labour, you see. Okay. Next, the godfather, Tony Blair. Let's see what they actually write about him here. Starmer will forever live in Tony Blair's shadow as the second Labour leader swept to power after a concerted effort to wrest the party away from the left. The pair have an open line of communication. Starmer moves on to the next big challenge, turning his campaign success into effective government. Blair championed the two men's connection when he invited Starmer on stage for a fireside chat / pep talk / you will listen to me and his influential think tank, the Tony Blair Institute, which is already furnishing the new government with both policy ideas and key staff. Starmer has said that he talks to Blair a lot about how his predecessor prepared for power in 1997. Blair's reach within the current party cannot be overstated. With the Blair grandee, with a Labour grandee immersing himself in blue sky questions about what AI means for the future of humanity, while Starmer battles more pressing demands. Blair has previously insisted he will not act as a backseat driver for his successor, though was notably quick off the mark with some public advice for Starmer on immigration policy in this weekend's Sunday Times. The new PM is certain to find himself wishing for his predecessor's guidance, whether directly or indirectly, when the chips are down. All right, so we know about Blair. There's also the Prince of Darkness, Peter Mandelson. He has been very, very present in the Labour Party stuff. He's been at all the conferences. He has been all over the radio and the TV coverage on election night. He was like a rash everywhere. Mandy was there. And of course, he is also Mr. New Labour 2.1. And he still has some pull within the party as well. But I, you know, he's closer to, I still think he's closer to Blair than appearances suggest. So let's carry on. Now these are the important people here now. Morgan McSweeney and Sue Gray. So let's see what is written on these. In opposition, Morgan McSweeney was Labour's campaign director, perhaps the most enigmatic figure at the centre of Starmer's world, and also the most crucial. After working in local government, he joined Labour Together, a think tank and campaign group dedicated to winning the party back from Corbyn and the hard left. McSweeney worked on Starmer's 2020 Labour leadership campaign after deciding he was the best-placed candidate to steer the party into a more electable position. He was right. McSweeney is widely credited with driving Labour's winning strategy through a combination of close attention to data and a conviction that the party needed to win back the disenchanted and the alienated, shifting back towards the centre ground. An Irishman married to one of Labour's new Scottish MPs, Imogen Walker, is expected to play a central role in shaping the narrative of Starmer's nascent government and targeting victory at the next election. His importance to the entire Starmer project is impossible to overstate. So it's important to get your head around this guy here, Morgan McSweeney. He is the new Alistair Campbell, basically, if you want to put it that way, or the new Mandelson, if you, or Mandelson and Campbell rolled into one. it's this man here. And, you know, he is not going to like the fact that the huge looming figure of Blair is backseat driving, constantly over the shoulder, whispering in Starmer's ear. And it's like, hold on a second, I'm the one running this show. And, you know, power hates a rival castle. Well, that even works on this tiny little micro scale of the court intrigue within the Labour Party. And I think McSweeney may be a rival castle to the Dark Lord himself. And that's going to be a central struggle. Is McSweeney going to be able to outflank Blair with all of his resources and all of his power? That's going to be interesting. Anyway, we'll come back to McSweeney in a second because Unheard, Who Is It For? I've got a piece on that, which I'll read in a second. Next, there's the fixer, Sue Gray. Starmer's chief of staff is a woman of apparent contradictions. She joined Labour last year after more than 40 years working her way to the top of the politically neutral civil service. Yeah, neutral. She is notoriously hard-nosed, yet also, reportedly, a great deal of fun. What's that link, then? What's the great deal of fun? Oh, yeah, okay. All right, then. Something to do with Partygate. Her task so far has been to make Labour a more disciplined, tightly focused operation, earning her both diehard fans and enemies in the process. Gray's reach is an extensive one, covering the party's relationship with the top civil servants, trade union bosses, and management of the shadow government. She takes a special interest in matters of ethics, having previously served the cabinet's office, most senior enforcer, will be on hand to navigate the murky personnel issues as they arise for Starmer and his new phalanx of MPs. Now, Sue Gray, I know less about this woman, but I do know that she is, she's talked about a lot. I mean, I watched a piece with David Starkey on New Culture Forum the other day after the election, and Starkey was going on about Gray as well, Sue Gray. I would like to know if she has any relationship with Blair. I would like to know some of the history between, if she was a civil servant, that means she could have worked with Blair or she could have, you know, been bullied by Blair. Because let's face it, the Labour New Point One. Yes, I get the impression, if I had to guess, I get the impression that Sue Gray is an anti-Blairite. Yeah, look. Look at this. Inside Sue Gray's battle for control of Labour. Glenn Owen and Dan Hodges reveal how Starmer's overbearing right-hand woman is plotting against. It's treason, man! Plotting against the Blairites in face-off over the levers of power. So, I mean, this is a problem. This woman is a problem if she's against the Blairites, right? Because it means that the factionalism that we talked about is already there at the very center of Starmer's government. Okay, and you can imagine the scene, can't you, right? Starmer's got his little team with his Sue Gray and his McSweeney and all these little minions around him, okay? They're trying to get things under control, and they're just surrounded. I mean, imagine a spider's web. Imagine Blair as a spider and all of these Blair minions swarming around Starmer, trying to bring him in, trying to wrest him away from Gray. This is very interesting indeed. And I don't know, I see a bit of drama on the horizon when it comes to New Labour 2.0, because power cannot tolerate a rival castle, and Blair is not going to take this. He's not going to be like, right, we didn't do all this work to get to maneuver New Labour 2.0 back into power, only to be pushed out by this stupid woman. So anyway, let's carry on. The old hand, there's Pat McFadden. He is another chap. Now, he is a Blair Brown era guy. He was around during that era. There's Matthew Doyle, another New Labour guy. Special advisor to David Blunkett. Again, a Blairite, basically. There's Wes Streeting. This chap here, he is a kind of mover and shaker within the Labour Party, I guess. There's Darren Jones, this fellow here. He is a Starmer man. Like, he's gonna, you see, this is the thing, is that every new king or prime minister, in this case, every new prime minister has to create their own people, right? People who are loyal to him. And I get the impression that this Darren Jones may be a Starmer loyalist, or at least Rachel Reeves one. There's Torsten Bell, who's a wonk, this chap on the right. An Anglo-Swede, well-known and well-liked figure. Parachuted into a safe seat. So there's a bit of wonk there. Now, I'd be interested to know Torsten Bell's relationship with the Dark Lord. Have they appeared on stage together? Is he that kind of high up, or is he not? Let's have a look. No, he is being called a Starmer Trooper. He is being called a Starmer Trooper. Starm Trooper, fucking hell. Meet the Starm Troopers. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. There she is, a Starm Trooper. So, yeah, I mean, this is the danger, basically, for the Dark Lord, that Starmer's got his own ideas, you know. I don't get the impression that Torsten Bell is Blair aligned, just from the looks of things. You know, it's pretty obvious usually when somebody's Blair aligned or not. It's not opaque most of the time. And then we've got the handler, Jessica Morden. While her name is unknown outside Westminster circles, Morden is an important backroom operator, parliamentary aide. She's effectively the eyes and ears. She's Starmer's spy, basically. Spy. You know, will help with the enforcement stuff. Okay. So, last thing I want to look at before we sign off tonight is the Unheard piece. Unheard, who is it for? By Tom McTague, called The McSweeney Project. Starmer's campaign director has gone to war on Blairism. War on Blairism. So Sue Gray is a problem. McSweeney is a problem for the Dark Lord. I will just read, this is a 14-minute read, apparently, so I'm not going to read it all, but we'll give you kind of filleted highlights. Blah, 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 blah. The McSweeney Project is not a restoration of Blairism, but a rejection of it. McSweeney has an aura of power. He is the architect and owner of the Starmer operation. This is his project, as one senior Labour figure put it. He designed it. He did the research. He drew the conclusions and he delivered Starmer. As such, McSweeney remains the untouchable advisor at the heart of today's Labour Party, the well source of Starmerism. McSweeney's influence has become a source of much speculation in Westminster and, of course, bitterness on the left, much of which sees him as a kind of ruthless Machiavel who's delivered the party into the hands of the Labour right through force of cunning and deception. And it should be said that there is some truth to this analysis. In the immediate aftermath of the 2017 campaign election, McSweeney took over as director of Labour Together, an organisation whose original intention was to shore up the Labour coalition, only to turn it into a tool to defeat the Corbynite left as the first step on the route back to power. Even in the days after the Grenfell Tower disaster, when it looked as though the Conservative government might fall, McSweeney did not waver in his commitment to remove Corbyn as the leader. So this McSweeney fellow is the Machiavel. He is the new Machiavelli in there, okay? In the 2 years that followed, McSweeney canvassed party members to identify what they needed from a Corbyn replacement, revealing a party membership that was not lost to a militant army of infiltrators, as some believed, but one that could be persuaded to back a figure from outside the Corbynite left as long as they were not advocating a return to the failures of the past. It was from this research that McSweeney alighted on Starmer, shadow Brexit secretary, who would return to Corbyn's shadow cabinet after his re-election as Labour leader in 2016 and away with him until the defeat in 2020. With McSweeney's guidance, Starmer offered Labour members a carefully constructed set of promises to increase taxes on the rich, abolish universal credit, scrap tuition fees, defend free movement of people, and initiate a green energy revolution. Starmer has ditched many of them since becoming leader. Taxes will not rise, freedom of movement will not return, and green investment will have to wait until there is money to pay for it. In the meantime, Jeremy Corbyn has been kicked out of the party. The left has lost almost all its influence and the old right has prospered. So is New Labour on its way back? Pat McFadden's elevation certainly suggests that the Blairites are back at the heart of today's Labour Party. McFadden was Tony Blair's personal political secretary and number 10 and remains a committed devotee of the old master. His wife, Mariana, meanwhile, is now McSweeney's deputy, having moved over from the Tony Blair Institute, which Starmer has praised as the very best of public policy innovation. Is this then a Blairite reconquista? No, says this unheard writer. And to see the McSweeney-Starmer project as a return to Blairism is to miss the point entirely. Over the past few months, I've spoken to many leading figures in the party who work with and know McSweeney, Starmer and Blair well. Not only does McSweeney reject Tony Blair's central analysis of politics and what Labour should do as a result, but for much of his time trying to retake the Labour Party, McSweeney was not just battling the Corbynite left, who were determined to maintain control of the party, but the Blairite right, many of whom had concluded it was already dead, but were determined to create something new in its place. The core of the McSweeney project, in other words, is not a restoration of Blairism, but a rejection of it. Now, this may all be true, but listen to what he's just said. Blair's old political secretary has his wife as McSweeney's deputy. Ready to wield the knife? I mean, Starmer's government is crawling, and I mean infested with Blairites. This McSweeney thinks he's going to be able to take them on? No. You don't put Blair away. Blair puts you away. And if I had to make a prediction, this McSweeney fellow is not going to last. There is no way McSweeney is going to be able to outmaneuver the Dark Lord. You can put money on that one. Not when he's got his personal hatchet men sitting right there in the government. No, Blairism will win. You can guarantee you. You can take that one to the bank. I'm not even going to make a bet on it. Anyway, into the and if McSweeney gets his way rather than Blair, Starmer's done. You've got to understand that Starmer is there basically on the good graces of the Dark Lord, not the other way around. So, I mean, this is the thing about Unheard, is that they, you know, I'm not always sure if they can ever quite see the wood for the trees when it comes to this. They're kind of good on this detail stuff, but they, I don't know. There's always something a little bit missing when it comes to the Unheard for me. They're coming from a different place. They're not. Anyway, let's continue. In 2017, the year Morgan McSweeney became director of Labour Together, Tony Blair created the Institute for Global Change. The DBI, as it became known, merged with various charities, businesses and other assorted organisations that the former Prime Minister had built since leaving office into one giant not-for-profit. Central to this venture was a new policy unit whose stated purpose was to renew the centre. Blair recruited, I mean, we know all of this stuff. We don't need to go into the creation of the TBI. In public, Blair insisted that he was not in any way advocating a new party, organizing blah, 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 blah. Okay. McSweeney found himself competing for donations with another group, yet trying to raise money, blah, blah, blah. So this was Blair. This was the attempt to create a new party from the Remain stuff, blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, we don't need to go into all these weeds. These are weeds. Okay, so let's just get to the conclusion here. The radicalism at the heart of the McSweeney-Starmer project is that it is, in effect, trying to prove Blair wrong, but using many of the tools Blair mastered to do so. When Starmer appeared alongside Blair on stage at the TBI's Future of Britain conference last year, widely reported as they're coming together, Starmer actually delivered a subtle rebuke of his predecessor's political argument. The project, he declared, speaking of his own designs on power, is to return Labour to the service of working people to become once again the natural vehicle for their hopes and aspirations. There were other projects available, he admitted. One alternative was what he called the rabbit hole of identity politics. But the other was more pointed. You could even completely unmorphed the concerns of working people, Starmer said as Blair watched on. That sounds ridiculous to me, but some people did seriously suggest it after the Brexit referendum. Starmer here is, of course, conveniently skating over his own support for the second referendum at the time. There is little doubt where his remarks were pointing. Starmer then went on to add, while he agreed with Blair that the technological revolution would be game-changing, there was one place where I do not take issue with Tony. The idea that this is somehow beyond left and right. No, for me, this is a progressive moment. Now, for Starmer, the lessons of recent history are not really Blairite at all. The left won our elections, he said, when it persuaded voters that it would deliver no matter how volatile. So basically what he's saying is that Starmer and this McSweeney chap are to the left of Blair, right? McSweeney believes that Blair has lost touch, basically, with the country. The trouble is with all this, okay, and the analysis of this Unheard chap here, who is basically, you know, Tom McTagui, right, is basically betting on McSweeney, saying like this is McSweeney's, like he rejects Blairism and blah blah blah. The trouble is that the argument of McSweeney and maybe of Starmer too, that moving to kind of restore the trust of working people failed. If you have a look at the election results, it didn't work. Working class people did not vote for Labour in the election. They voted for reform in massive numbers. Labour were not the beneficiaries. There were very few Tory to Labour switch voters in the election. All that happened was that the Tory vote collapsed. So the McSweeney argument that appealing to the working class is wrong, basically, hasn't worked. And notably, the posher parts of the country went Lib Dem. They didn't go Labour, right? There were no Tory to Labour switches down south at all. So I feel like Blair and co are gonna be like, well, hold on a second. If you look at the 1997 and the 2005 and the you know, the Blair maps, basically, he was able to appeal right across the country with his kind of message. So this will be an interesting fight to see play out, but this is the person to keep an eye on. If you see McSweeney is out, you know Blair has won, right? If you see McSweeney is out, Blair has won. Basically what this is that McSweeney is aware that Blair and Davos and neoliberalism is toxic as a brand to lots of people now, right? And he is right about that. But betting against power, betting that this guy, this McSweeney guy, is going to be able to have it together to defeat basically the dark avatar of Davos, Blair himself, it's far-fetched, I think. So, but we'll see. We will see. So that is it. Morgan McSweeney is the anti-Blair man in the Starmer camp, and he's very central to the project. So going forward, we need to keep an eye on what happens to him and what happens to Sue Gray. Gray and McSweeney are the two key Starmer people. If you see them gone and replaced with Blairites, you know Blair has truly won. If you carry on seeing headlines that, oh no, the government isn't going to go down this route and we're not going to take on ID cards and blah, 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 you know that those guys are winning. So that is the story behind the story. I hope you enjoyed this. I'm going to have to run, folks. Any super chats, we will pick them up down the line. I have an exceptionally busy July. I'll be back tomorrow night for Unpopular Opinions. But most importantly of all, ladies and gentlemen, oh yes, do buy my courses at the Academic Agency. Foundations of Writing is a good one to start with, especially if you're a BBC journalist who doesn't know how to use commas. But most importantly of all, ladies and gentlemen, get out.
Traveling across the seas to help save all the other countries, but the day you left, the country fell to its knees. So I say, Tony Blair, T-Man, B-L-A-I-O, you're in our hearts. I know you had to go, it doesn't stop it hurting. So I say, Tony Blair, with your gentle face, your heart of gold and strength of God. The day you left this place, the country went to the docks. But I know you're only one man in the world that needs fixing. If I could, I'd gather all your friends. Together we'd all pitch in. And when the world was fixed, we'd gather round the people in their millions. And we'd raise the crown to the new King Tony Blair. God save us. Gracious Tony Blair, long live our noble Tony Blair. God save our gracious Tony Blair, long live our noble Tony Blair. God save.